I'd like to welcome you to this latest Alborada Online. I'm a co-editor, founder of Alborada, which is an independent media outlet covering Latin American media, politics, and culture. And we've been running these Alborada Online events since around April 2020, so shortly after the pandemic began. We've done a number that touched on Brazil and issues related to Brazil. But we're delighted to be hosting this event with four fantastic speakers exploring what's at stake in Brazil in Sunday's election that pits the fascist incumbent president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, with the former left-wing president, Lula da Silva. Now, my co-chair, Gabriela, hopefully, is around. I think I've seen her name, so that's good. She's in Salvador. In Brazil, I'm not in Salvador, I'm in the UK, in Sheffield, less tropical for sure. But we'll be co-chairing this event, which hopefully will last just on, bring us up to about 8:30 UK time. So we have, as I said, four great speakers. We have Giuliano Fiori, an essayist and Alborada contributing editor. We have Sabrina Fernandez, a Brazilian journalist and founder of Tenze Onze, a portal for political education and the dissemination of eco-socialist ideas. Giuliano is based in Rio. Sabrina is based in Brazil, I think, also. We have Michael Fox, a Brazilian-based freelance multimedia journalist and host and producer of Brazil on Fire podcast, an excellent podcast that you should check out on the Real News Network, and hopefully we can share the link for that in the comment section. He's joining us from Florianópolis, I believe, so also Brazil. And we have Natalia Urban, a Brazilian journalist for outlets such as Brazil Wire and Brazil 247, who I think is joining us a little bit later. I don't think she's connected yet, but she will be coming. She's based in the UK. So just want to say, yeah, if you want to know more about Alborada, check our website, alborada.net. You can sign up to our e-newsletter. I think someone will share a link to the last e-newsletter that we sent out this morning in the chat section. Just to say, the event will be recorded. The idea is that we give each speaker 5 to 7 minutes to explore the central question of the event, what's at stake in Brazil. And then Gabriela and I will do pick-up questions and take comments from the chat. So please do, you know, send your comments into the chat as soon as possible. We'll try and make it as dynamic as possible, get as many of you in, asking, and get the panelists debating the issues. So without further ado, I'll hand you over to Gabriela, who will, I think, set the scene a little bit, and then invite Giuliana to start. So Gabriela.
Thank you, Pablo, and hi, everyone. I'm Gabriela de Oliveira, British-Brazilian, currently in Salvador, as Pablo said, and a member of the Alborada community, and very happy to be here today. So just to set the scene very briefly before handing over to our first speaker. So we're here to discuss these really important elections happening on Sunday this week. We've had the first round of the vote, so generally there are two rounds in Brazilian elections. Candidates can win in the first round if they get over 50%. Lula was just shy of that with 48.4% and came out as the top candidate in the first round on the 2nd of October, with Bolsonaro as the second candidate at 43.2%. So a closer margin than a lot of the polls were predicting. And the Partido Liberal, the PL, which is Bolsonaro's party, got the highest number of seats in the Senate and the House, something that we can, I'm sure, get into today. So there might be implications if Lula does win this Sunday, what it will actually be like to govern the country. The polls currently are saying that the votes are kind of closing. So Lula has grown in popularity since the first round, but as has Bolsonaro. And there's a number of reasons for that, which we can get into. The two other kind of bigger candidates, but much smaller than the first two, have thrown their weight behind Lula, one more enthusiastically than the other. But we're yet to see the impact of that in the polls significantly. As we know, there's still strong anti-Lula sentiment amongst the middle and upper classes, particularly that kind of fascist wing, that are strong Bolsonaro supporters. Bolsonaro's gained votes in the working class due to a kind of emergency support during the pandemic, which has continued, and particularly the last payment of that he's brought forward to happen just a couple of days before the election. And he's still got a lot of a stronghold in the evangelical churches, which I'm sure we'll get onto. So we're hoping today to talk about what we can expect in the next week. We've currently seen increasing violence, Bolsonaristas against PT activists and supporters, and disinformation, which has been an ongoing theme in a well-oiled machine during Bolsonaro's time in power. We want to discuss whether or not Lula will win, are the polls right, and how and what we think about that, and what can we expect from Bolsonaro and his supporters if Lula does win. Will we see our own storming of the Capitol or worse? And then finally, if Lula is inaugurated on the 1st of January, what will it be like for him to govern from 2023 onwards in this post-Bolsonaro Brazil? How deep did the changes and the transformation fascism that we've seen in Brazil in the last 4 years really go? So I'll stop there and I'll hand over to our first speaker, Juliano. Juliano, I'd be really interested to hear your take on and how you're reading the situation currently, what you think is really important for us to be looking out for as we come up to Sunday's vote.
Thanks a lot, Gabby, and thanks to Pablo, thanks to Alborada for the invitation, and hello to my colleagues on the panel. So I'll get straight into the question: what's at stake? Of course, Bolsonaro is of the new nihilistic right, and Lula is identified with the center left, but certainly we're not talking here about socialism or barbarism. In fact, it'd probably be too optimistic even to be talking about civilizational barbarism. In simplistic terms, perhaps what we're talking about here is the possibility of putting the brakes on a process for which Bolsonaro and Bolsonarismo represent an acceleration. And this is a process of demodernization, of capitalist disintegration. In human terms, or in terms of the human implications, it's a process of annihilation. And ultimately, I suppose we could describe it as a process of barbarization. But to expand on that a little bit, we have to give an explanation of what each of the candidates represent, starting with Bolsonaro. And so how does Bolsonaro come to be president of a country like Brazil? Well, I'd say something of a response, a mimetic response to a society in collapse, even a society in psychological collapse. I don't mean to say by that that everyone in Brazil has gone mad, rather that there's been a sufficient choice for a project of annihilation because there don't seem to be alternatives to the social terms in which people exist currently. So going a bit deeper below the surface of this choice for collapse, of collapse. Bolsonaro only really emerges as the inexorable presidential candidate in the moment in which a new type of politics is on the rise in Brazil. So Bolsonaro is something of an invention. He's not grown organically through politics. He's somebody that comes into politics as the dregs of the worst elements of the military dictatorship. But he emerges as a viable candidate precisely when what Brazilian philosopher Rodrigo Nunes has called described as sort of entrepreneurial politics is on the rise in Brazil. This is, I suppose, politics as sort of private business, politics for sort of personal profiteering. And this is a politics that doesn't just foster criminality, but it actually functions through criminality. And in this regard, it's important to recognize that criminality in contemporary Brazil is in fact a sort of entrepreneurialism par excellence. And this politics is on the rise in Brazil sort of in the middle of this last decade, probably as an expression of Brazilian capitalism reaching certain inner limits, the limits of an orderly developmentalism, and Bolsonaro offering the possibility of new ways of expanding Brazilian capitalism. He is the candidate of destruction, of spoliation that can allow Brazilian capitalism to expand beyond certain frontiers, new frontiers. And the counterpart to this in social terms is a sort of war of all against all. It's pitting people against each other in a moment in which what was the work society also starts to disintegrate. In opposition to this project of accelerating destruction is Lula and his camp. And it's important to recognize that Lula here is not really a candidate of the Workers' Party as such. He is representing a broad front of opposition to Bolsonaro and his project. So I suppose it could be characterized as a sort of negative of what Bolsonaro is, a negation of Bolsonaro's project. But even if Lula was on his own with his own project, trying to reproduce what he managed to do in his two previous mandates from 2003 to 2010, it wouldn't be a project of social transformation as such. It would be a project of managing the effects of this process of disintegration, of perhaps putting the brakes on this process of disintegration. And now we are in social conditions which are more challenging to be able to do that. And so Lula is in the lead, as you said, Gabi, and he will face a difficult legislative scenario if he is elected. But it's not just his politicking with the legislature that will make the difference. He is also at the helm of a broad coalition, which has to position itself as maintaining a minimum sort of order that can protect life in the context of this process of disintegration.
Thanks, Giuliano. Thanks for those initial thoughts. I want to turn to Sabrina. I kind of want to keep the question super open-ended, and I want to give Sabrina the chance to explore the central thing that we called it What's at Stake. I mean, obviously reflect on what Giuliano has said, but what do you feel is at stake in Brazil this Sunday? What can Lula do if he does come to power? What does Bolsonarismo, how has it embedded itself into the structures, into the institutions of Brazil? How permanent will it be, and hard will it be to tackle? So yeah, Sabrina, welcome, and give us your thoughts.
Thank you, Pablo. Thank you to everyone at Alborada and those of you who are here to discuss with us this very, very difficult set of elections here in Brazil. We've been saying that this is the hardest elections in recent history of Brazil. This also means that maybe in 4 years will be the hardest, and things will keep going because we are dealing with sort of what, in terms of what Giuliano has mentioned, we are trying to stop certain things from getting worse, but we already know that in terms of the fabric of Brazilian society, we are dealing with huge issues in terms of depoliticization, huge issues in terms of how people perceive politics in everyday life and how they connect that to a presidential candidate or a political party. When we mentioned that in the first round of the elections, we had the highest absentee number for the past years, this means a lot, because in Brazil, when you have the first round, you have a lot of different presidential candidates. You don't have only the two or three. So people could have gone in a different direction, yet they chose not to go out to vote. We know that this is partly because of this crisis of representation, something that we've been trying to grasp for the past 10 years or so. June 2013, the massive protests that we had in Brazil were like that. That was a moment that really highlighted this crisis of representation for us. And we're still not quite sure what to get out of it, because this alt-right was able to take good advantage of this process, yet the left in its fragmentation and its fight over institutional hegemony didn't do the same. So this is something that we're still dealing with effects here in Brazil. Like we need to be quite aware of that. But the absentee situation is also important when we consider class in Brazil. We found out from polling and numbers that some of the reasons why people didn't go out to vote was you have to get public transit so you can get out to vote, even though it's mandatory. But then that ends up being more expensive than you staying home and just paying a small fine to justify your absence later on. So there are many different issues, and this is why there's a campaign throughout the country to get free transit on Sunday ahead of the elections. We've been successful already in a few major cities, but this is still a fight that's going on. So I'm based in São Paulo right now. São Paulo is going to get free transit. We know this is going to be important, so much that the Bolsonaro camp was trying to bar this conversation from going forward. So they are quite aware that Lula lost votes in the first round because of people staying at home. So it wasn't just a crisis of representation right there. But we understand that things are getting tougher as well, because the Bolsonarista camp basically decided it has nothing to lose. So they are playing with many different tactics at the same time. And in the case they do get, for example, called out on something or punished because of something, they can spin the narrative in a certain way as well. So we've been talking about misinformation chaos right now. So it's not just fake news, it's not just about lies, but using those lies as a means to get the attention of the courts, and so that the courts can actually persecute them if the court wants to do so. And then they'll claim persecution, they claim censorship, they claim that the leftist dictatorship has already begun. And this goes very much in line with this approach that Bolsonaro has shown in the past few months, talking about other countries in Latin America with progressive governments, and making an appeal again, just like we had last time, that, well, Brazil will turn into Venezuela or something like that. But this time he's been talking a lot about Nicaragua. And then if you tune in into like the Brazilian news shows coming from, for example, the conservative channel, Jornal da Record, that's very much supporting Bolsonaro. Like the news segment actually looks like an extension of the Bolsonaro electoral ads. And they would be talking like for like 8-9 minutes about the persecution of priests in Nicaragua or something like that. When in Brazil, the evangelical fundamentalist core that's supporting Bolsonaro has been attacking Catholic priests and Catholic fests in Brazil. So it's a way of actually like getting people attention, to pay attention to something that's happening outside, spinning the narrative, saying that the dictatorship is coming, and playing on the anti-communist fears that had already been common in Brazil for a while. But Bolsonaro and his camp, they've been very vocal about this from the beginning. So, and they will make these parallels, either making claims about Maduro in Venezuela or about Boric in Chile. And they, and we're talking about governments in Latin America that actually don't talk that much to each other, right? But for Bolsonaro, it's about playing on the ghost of communism here. And this means that these evangelical leaders, Gabriela mentioned this in the beginning, the evangelical vote is important here, because evangelical leaders have been quite vocal. We cannot forget that one of Bolsonaro's main mottos is about God above everything. So God and nation. So he talks about God, nation, family, and is always in the sense of appealing to the evangelicals rather than to the Christian sense in general. And when he does that, it means that he has a lot of powerful leaders with him, André Valadão, Silas Malafaia, and a lot of money. Also the fact that the mega churches in Brazil, they're not just regular churches that people will attend on Sunday, they also own means of communication, right? So RECORD is a main one coming from Igreja Universal, but we also know there's a lot of community radio, there's cable TV programming that they pay on regular radio and regular TV as well. And this has been shaping people ideologically for a really long time. This is why they talk about gender ideology as something that should scare people about the ending the family or something like that. And one of the big things that they've been talking about in this election is the fear of a unisex bathroom. So again, talking about gender ideology, when we've been trying to make a counterpoint here that they've been talking about, you know, how they're afraid of their children going to a unisex bathroom when we have almost 4,000 schools in Brazil without proper anything bathrooms for the Brazilian children, right? So the level of the situation that Brazilians find themselves in right now is a direct conflict between these narratives and the ideological construction coming from Bolsonarismo and the actual material reality that's of absolute despair. We estimate that we have perhaps 500,000 people living in the streets of Brazil today. Is a number that has grown more than twofold from when Bolsonaro came into power. And there's absolutely no conversation about this coming from the Bolsonaro government. It's how bad the pandemic was as well, with about 700,000 people killed because of this delay in the vaccines and not wanting to ensure proper social distancing measures coming from the federal government as well. So I absolutely agree with Juliano that we're at this point that we're looking for some level of stability here that Lula can provide. However, we are aware that Lula is bringing a lot of contradictions to the table. When you look into the written program, like the government program that was released by the coalition supporting Lula earlier in the year, before the campaign began, there are a lot of elements there that are more progressive and I would even say like properly leftist in nature. For example, when they talk about energy transition, when they talk about public inclusive education, there are matters that we need to ensure stay at the forefront. There's like progressive tax reform and things like that. But when Lula gets closer to the elections, he starts making newer concessions to get more allies. And this is the situation that we're left in the second round, because now the coalition went from this big to something like a very, very, very broad front, bringing people even to the right of Lula's vice president, who was someone that we have been criticizing from the beginning for being quite a right-wing VP. So things have gone even further, conversations with agribusiness, with the evangelicals. But for example, we already know that the gap in terms of voting between Bolsonaro and Lula in the evangelical electorate has reduced. So Bolsonaro is losing a little bit of the evangelical vote, and Lula is also gaining a little bit of the evangelical vote. We don't know quite yet if this means this is because Lula is making these level concessions and because there are some evangelical leaders who are coming in and supporting Lula from a progressive standpoint, because there are leftist Christians fighting in the Lula campaign to get Lula elected, or it's a direct result of like Bolsonaro really failing to abide by the values that the more conservative evangelicals identified Bolsonaro with before, and with Bolsonaro, for example, making claims recently sexualizing young Venezuelan girls in Brazil, if this had like a direct effect on those people losing trust. And I'm going to close here for now.
Great. Thank you, Sabrina. I think you brought a lot of complexity to the surface, which makes the discussion all the more interesting. And thank you to everyone putting questions in the chat. I'll shift over to Michael now. Michael, I think from what I've heard, you've been traveling around a bit and kind of getting a read of the situation in different parts of Brazil. So I'll pass over to you to hear your views on what's happening.
Sounds good. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure. Very excited for all of this. Everyone who's talked so far has so much to say, and I've been writing down notes like, oh, I should mention these other things that are laid on top. But of course, with very few minutes, I have been traveling around the country. So far, I've been in 5 states over the last few weeks. I'm headed to Rio Grande do Sul tomorrow and then back to Sao Paulo. And obviously, you know, I was up in Pernambuco, which is the state where Lula is from. Up there, a lot of excitement in the streets for a rally with Lula. Like everyone I spoke to, you know, he won the first round with roughly 67%, and people are really excited to have him back. Right now, I'm in Santa Catarina, which is in the south, and I was actually at a rally yesterday with Michele Bolsonaro and Damares Alves, Bolsonaro's former human rights minister. And if, you know, you've got 2,000. Women for Bolsonaro who are religious and evangelical and really excited to have Bolsonaro. So obviously things are extremely polarized, and that, you know, exactly what Sabrina was just talking about just makes everything that much more complicated. And with the fake news and this information campaign, I've been doing a lot of speaking with a lot of people about that. And that's one of the main themes that everyone I've spoken to says they've never seen anything like this. And I'm talking about in the United States and Brazil, the level of the disinformation and the fake news, the attacks by Bolsonaro has been extreme, just you know, like nothing we've ever seen before. Now, the electoral court has been pushing back like we've also never seen. Is it enough? Maybe not. But what Alexandre Moraes, the lead justice here, what he did just a couple of days ago is said, look, we are only going to allow social media platforms 2 hours to take down any new post that we might see online that is fake news. You need to take it down without 2 hours. So they've been really pushing back very quickly. And that's been important within this whole thing. What we also see, which has been really interesting from the Lula camp, is pushback as well and putting Bolsonaro on the defensive with videos showing, you know, Bolsonaro campaigning in Masonic lodges and the pedophile thing, and then saying that Bolsonaro would eat human flesh. Those have been kind of videos not cut up, not necessarily fake news, but pushed out on social media to really hit the moral, these issues of the values and the moral and the family values, which is at the heart of what Bolsonaro's campaign is. And I think this is really key. You know, Lula, obviously, he comes from the working class. That's his bread and butter. And that's what he's been hammering on the entire time about, you know, coming back to the good old days of the 2000s. Bolsonaro has been focusing very, very clearly on a campaign of holy war. Bolsonaro and of course his wife Michele, of the holy war, of the values, the culture war, which is what Sabrina was just talking about. And I think this is really key to understanding kind of where we are right now. Bolsonaro, he can't win on kind of the levels of, oh, look, poverty has fallen, or the economy is really great. It's not. Inflation, the new figures just came out, and it's risen again after 2 months that was dropping. Things are not good. So what he's hammering on, what he's been doing for month after month, and this is why he's kind of brought on the first lady to come in and speak with women up and down the country, is because what he can win on is this question of faith, right? This question of morals, of family values. And this is why all these levels of the campaign, all the attacks against Lula, you know, trying to connect him with criminals, trying to connect him with other things, talking about corruption, the unisex bathroom stuff, is all things to really get at that base of the evangelical movement. Right now, currently in the country, evangelicals make up roughly a third of Brazil. They continue to grow, and they are a huge base, and at least a majority, like roughly at least half of evangelicals, and it looks like it might be even more, are backing Bolsonaro in this election. So that is why he keeps hammering that home. And this is kind of the last week before those elections. I think we're going to see even more things kick off, because of course the Supreme Electoral Court has the ability to move, but not when it's getting attacked and whatnot, when people are getting bombarded by fake news just constantly. So I think what we're going to see in the next week is even more of that ramping up. I did want to just mention something I think is really important that people within the Lula campaign have been talking about from the very beginning, and that is these two issues of unity and democracy. And this is what Lula and of course the Workers' Party, but also social movements, the MST, the MTST, and so many other movements that have come on to his coalition have been talking about, this difference between democracy versus dictatorship. That's been very much kind of the language. Of course, Bolsonaro representing dictatorship, that's what he would like, right? He just doesn't have it yet. And then Lula, this idea of bringing democracy back to Brazil. And that's a really key theme. Of course, there's going to be issues if he's able to come into power later on. There's going to be complications with the huge amount of Bolsonaro supporters and allies that are in Congress and the Senate. But that is really kind of the framing Which everyone is really fighting. And I've been, you know, meeting with a lot of different folks, like I mentioned. In fact, I spoke with a woman named Rosa Morin, who was one of the MST candidates who just won up in Recife just a little bit ago. And what this represents for them is exactly that, a possibility, a return to something that's feasible, a return to some sort of semblance of a democratic norm. And, you know, why is this so important? What are the stakes? Well, because going in the direction, going in the direction of Bolsonaro means the possibility for Bolsonaro to deepen everything he's already done, the gutting of social institutions, the gutting of the environment, the gutting of the indigenous institutions, re-implementing, pushing even harder in terms of family values and codifying that within the Ministry of Human Rights and Women for the Family and Women. But on a much deeper level, it means like the pushback on the ability of the social movements to be able to organize. But also, one of the things that Bolsonaro's done is this unleashing of this white supremacy, this unleashing of this pseudo-fascism. We saw within the first 2 or 3 years of the Bolsonaro government a rise in neo-Nazi cells by 60%. So what pushback against Bolsonaro would mean in this election is the ability to roll that back as much as possible, because how do you put the genie back in the bottle once it's been released? And that's what Bolsonaro has done in so many ways. Now, I know we're going to get into the Amazon in a little bit. I saw a ton of questions there. We can talk about that for all. That's why I didn't really want to mention it right now. But I will say that this is obviously huge. But what's fascinating, and this is important for an international audience, is the Amazon is not an issue right now in these elections. I mean, the environment it is for some folks, but that's not what's happening right now. It's a really important issue abroad. It's probably the major issue that's been talked about in the international press. But locally, it's almost been an organizing tool for the right and for Bolsonaro supporters. If you lay side by side on top of it, the areas that were deforested over the last, of the Amazon and the Amazon region of the last 20 or 30 years, you see an almost clear parallel with the regions and the municipalities that most had deforestation and those municipalities that actually won for Bolsonaro in this last, in this first round of election. So that is a major concern, because those are areas where people are actually using that. And there was reports that, for instance, in the state of Rondônia, which is where I was just a couple of weeks ago, you had actual landowners and farmers, staunch supporters of Bolsonaro, that were out organizing against their own people, saying, listen, if Lula comes back into power, then he's gonna kick you off of indigenous territories. He's going to stop you from being able to move on to indigenous territories. And that's why you need to get out the vote for Bolsonaro. So these types of things, there are very, very powerful interests, as we know, all across the region. And although in, say, the state of Amazonas, which was much more equally distributed and much more pushed down the side of Lula, you have in the state of Rondônia, Bolsonaro won by 2/3. And that's the same reality in so many different places. So those are major concerns for what is the actual future of the Amazon look like when you have so much pushback from land grabbers and powerful landowners and whatnot. So I'll stop it there. There's so much to say, but I'm sure we'll get into it in a little bit.
Thank you so much, Michael. And I think someone's shared the link to your podcast, but I would recommend people check out 6-part podcast that Michael's produced and hosts. Now, Natalia, I see, has entered the event, so that's good. Natalia, I'd like to take it somewhere else a little bit and ask you a little bit about what a Lula victory, and, you know, as we've said, that the polls are relatively tight, but they do point to a Lula victory at the moment. What would a Lula government represent, I think, regionally? We've discussed that there are serious possible constraints as to what he might be able to deliver. That might be because of the balance of power in the Congress and the Senate, but also because of some of the alliances perhaps that he's developed. But what do you think his government would represent regionally? How would it position itself amongst this left, this new left that some people say, the resurgence of the left? Obviously, Lula was part of the initial pink tide. He was part of that. He was often described as part of the sort of good left as opposed to the bad left of Chavez and others. But what would a Lula government in 2000 and a new Lula government represent? How would it position itself in that left that, as Sabrina says, ranges from something like Nicaragua and Venezuela and Cuba to something like Boric, where these two lefts often, well, certainly Boric has been extremely critical of governments of Nicaragua and Venezuela. So, yeah, tell us about Lula's sort of positioning.
Well, I think the most important that we have to keep in mind is that Lula is someone that really respects a country's sovereignty. So he was always very clear every time they tried to attack him using Nicaragua, using Venezuela, talking about Cuba, etc. He was always like, listen, I might not agree with everything they are doing, but it's not up to me. It's their people's choice to have those leaders. And we have to respect the people's choice. We have to respect that the people went to the polls and vote for them, and they are there, and the people like them. So this is, we cannot work against them. We have to be respectful of them. And I think one of the things that is the most important thing aspect of Lula is that he's very much into developing not just Brazil, but South America, and most importantly, Latin America in general, as because he understands that it doesn't matter if Brazil is going well, if other countries around us are not going well. So that's why he was always very open about supporting the gas from Bolivia to Brazil, the negotiations within not just Mercosul, but like this training of a proper UNASUR, the strengthening of like regional mechanisms of developing from everybody, because he understands that it's important not just for Brazil but for whole Latin America. He has this very clear on him, and maybe it might be because Lula told me himself that he doesn't consider him as he doesn't believe in imperialism, because he said that for him Brazil and other countries in Latin America are still experiencing economical mainly and political colonialism, in a sense that we don't have, we still have the countries that colonized us calling all the shots. So for him, the process of like independence of these countries is still like an ongoing progress. So that's why he was very adamant in working together for the better good for of the region, because he knows that it will if we have an imbalance between the countries, one of the countries will end up receiving more people and carrying the burden, the burdening of the economical of the region, especially regarding Mercosul and trade deals and stuff. So this is something that he doesn't want. He wants to have people always, all the countries being developing equally. And one of the things that I think it's very different from Bolsonaro, for example, which is that we have to be very mindful, is when we have the so-called first wave of pink tide, we have a far-right government, Uribe, in Colombia. Lula never did anything against Uribe. He had like diplomatic relationships with Colombia government. He respect Colombian government and everything. But Bolsonaro is the opposite. Bolsonaro is always trying to undermine, and this is the most difficult aspect of this elections when we are talking about Latin America, is that we have to always remember that Bolsonaro is part, even though Steve Bannon says that Lula is the postal boy, the poster boy of the globalist left, but like Bolsonaro is in fact part of the movement by Steve Bannon of Foro de Madrid with people from Vox in Spain. And so he's always trying to work to undermine those governments. He's always trying to undermine and tarnish the everything that the left in especially Bolivia, the government in Argentina are their favorite targets of this current government. And Lula would be someone that would be willing to deal with everybody, because he really, really wants South to South developing, because he himself being a victim of the DOJ with the lawfare, the car wash operation, etc. He understands the importance of a regional strengthening without the presence of the United States. So he wouldn't want to be the person that is trying to interfere in other countries' foreign policy or their local policy, like it was in Brazil with him, because he knows him, he felt how bad it was for him. And we always have to also be mindful that even though Bolsonaro likes to say, use that as a bad thing, but like Lula is one of the founders of Foro de São Paulo. He's someone that was always interested and cultivate the international links of the left in Latin America, because this is really important for our regional development and also very important for us as for our identity as Latinos to always work together against a common enemy. The common enemy being the Western countries that are imposing inequality in our continent, that continue with that mentality that we are there to be their backyard, their front yard, like Biden likes to say now, or even like a country that they can explore still and continue to like their colonialist mentality when people are trying to do trying to achieve a new level of local developing. And this will be, in my view, a big challenge for Lula, especially in the moment we are living right now with the United States trying to, in all sorts of ways, undermine the relations of the BRICS, of the new pink tide, of anything that is that goes against their agenda of unipolar world with them being the center of everything. And I don't believe that he will be a president after everything he went through with his imprisonment and everything, that he will accept the orders or even the attempts of interference, especially from the United States and the European Union. I think regarding especially the environment, it's going to be a few clashes because we have to be very mindful that Lula was someone that said that we will continue to explore our oil through Petrobras. Of course, he wants to start developing more eco-friendly initiatives, but we know that one of the reasons why he was imprisoned, that PT was a victim of an international plot to remove them from power, was because of pre-sal in Brazil, because of the amount of oil we have in Brazil. And that oil, the profits from that oil were being used to finance educational programs and developing programs that change lives of millions of people in Brazil. So we cannot like pretend that this will not also be an issue right now, because we have that hypocrisy coming from Western countries regarding of imposing green initiatives from like countries that have been unable to have their same level of industrial development that they have nowadays. So I would say that one of the most important things that I'm looking forward to see is Lula reactivating UNASUR, Brazil being again the big active player on making the voice of Latin America, especially the South America, because now we have AMLO in Mexico as well, but being the voice of South America for international markets, for international organizations of developing and everything, and also protecting the smaller countries against attempts of coup or even attempts of like foreigner interference. We can never forget that Today, we only have Xiomara Castro in Honduras because Brazil clashed with the United States and saved Manuel Zelaya's family in 2010. And even against the United States orders, Lula said, no, we're going to save them. We don't going to deal with terrorists. We don't deal with the people, what they are doing. Zelaya is a good guy, and we're going to save him and his family. And now we have Xiomara Castro in Honduras. Thanks, Lula. So I would say, just to finish, that one of the things that also I think it will be extremely important for Brazil with Lula in presidency is to actually discover and like revealing all the crimes that Bolsonaro committed against Latin America, especially regarding the participation of Brazil in the Bolivian coup, the participation of Brazil and the protests in Chile, the participation of Brazil and protests in Ecuador, and of course the undermining of the Argentinian government. And I think that whilst we have Bolsonaro in power, even though we have all those like center-left progressive presidents in all the other countries in South America, and the majority of countries in South America, South America would never be truly progressive without Brazil being again under the Workers' Party government. So thank you.
Thank you, Natalia. Really interesting to have that kind of outwards zoom out and context of thinking about neighboring countries. And obviously we've seen a lot how Lula has definitely played to his international credibility as a way of also increasing his popularity in the lead up to the elections. And that's something he's got a very long history of, and something that he can build on. And Bolsonaro definitely is a stark contrast to that in terms of relationships with other governments and how he's perceived around the world. Okay, we've had loads of interesting questions come in on the chat. So what we'll do is we'll go to a couple of the speakers and bring some of these questions out. We might, Pablo and I, cut in, but that's only so that we can get through all of the questions. So please don't be offended. So I think there are a few questions that are really about what's next. We can talk a little bit. There's a few afterwards that are about what's happening on Sunday, which we can come back to maybe. But there's a question here, and Juliana, I'll come to you. You mentioned about, you know, Lula being part of this kind of broader front, which was really about something against Bolsonaro, kind of uniting against Bolsonaro and getting him out. And that there is a lot of kind of nuance in the coalitions that he's built. Obviously, some parts of Brazil, there's genuine excitement and support to have Lula back. And then other parts of Brazil, it's not so simple, and our different communities have different relationships to Lula. And like we mentioned, there's still a lot of anti-Lula sentiment, particularly in Bolsonaro supporters. So there are a few questions. There are some comments around the importance of the Supreme Court nominations that will be coming up in the next presidential election. There's also questions on if Lula wins, the Bolsonarismo that we've all referred to today, which goes much beyond just Bolsonaro himself, will continue to exist. So Juliano, what do you see this next government, in the case that Lula wins, looking like, and how might Lula kind of deal with the Bolsonarismo and deal with some of the changes that have happened during this time? And I just want to pick up on the last point that you mentioned, that was about Bolsonaro's expanding capitalism, something that had started and, well, has existed for a long time, but Bolsonaro kind of pushing that to the extreme. And we've seen that in terms of the management of FUNAI, the kind of national body that's for the protection of indigenous people, and also around the Amazon, which Michael talked about. So I've kind of tried to put a few questions together, and essentially kind of what's next and what do you see?
Yeah, and there's a lot to cover there. So I suppose I'll focus on Bolsonarismo and the opposition to it. And maybe I'll leave the stuff about the Supreme Court to others. But first, addressing that last point, I wasn't suggesting that there's a general expansion of Brazilian capitalism. What I'm saying is that Bolsonaro enables the expansion on certain frontiers of accumulation, where there's a violent process of shift, which is most notable in the Amazon region and in the center west, which is the sort of heartland of agribusiness. And it's not surprising then, perhaps, that in fact, local economies have been built into and around the criminality that is required to expand these frontiers. And therefore, there is support for the expansion of these frontiers, not only amongst big capitalists, but also amongst smaller producers that benefit from these new criminal economies that emerge in these frontiers of accumulation. This is partly explicative of why Bolsonaro manages to get support not just from the elite in some of these regions. And it's important to recognize why there is such thing as Bolsonarismo popular in other parts of the country as well. I suppose start with talking about Bolsonarismo itself, and it's a slightly nebulous term, and there's debates that have raised over the last 4 years as to whether Bolsonarismo is the right term and what precisely it describes, whether it's a sort of ideological formation, even though it's clearly of anything like systematic ideology, or whether it's just a broad sort of political movement that emerges around the figure of Bolsonaro as invented in the way that I described previously. But there is certainly something of a contradiction on the left that I suppose is demonstrative of a difficulty we face in understanding the phenomenon. And in some sense, we need to understand the phenomenon well in order to really truly challenge it and to let's say to root it out. And that is, on the one hand, it's almost impossible to deny that Bolsonarismo will continue, given even just looking at the results of the first round, to see how many hardcore Bolsonaristas made it into the House and the Senate. But also seeing how divided the country is in terms of the presidential vote and the fact that this is going down to the wire in a way that, if you think about what Bolsonaro has done over the last 4 years, it really shouldn't be. If we think about the fact that Lula has had to build this very broad coalition to overcome Bolsonaro, it's demonstrative of the fact that Bolsonarismo really has rooted itself in this country. So on that one hand, the impossibility of denying that Bolsonarismo will outlast Bolsonaro if Bolsonaro loses. On the other, there's still this commitment to the idea that the left's weakness over the last 6 years has been a product of interference and intrigue, as if that's the primary factor. The social formation of Brazil, or even deformation of Brazil, has in itself contributed to the rise of Bolsonarismo as a social and political phenomenon. That if it wasn't for the meddling of the US and of imperialism, etc., that the PT would be fine, would be continuing its program of progressive reforms and inclusion, etc., that it was engaging in from 20 years ago onwards through its 3.5 mandates. And the reason why I raise this is because there's a tendency with this view of the last few years of history that focuses on interference, on manipulation, on conspiracy, to actually undermine the possibility of building anything like a solid base for progressive politics in Brazil. It not only denies the importance, but it denies the viability of internal social struggle. Because if there's this all-powerful system that dominates every time to get up and do something, then you might ask, what's the point in doing anything at all? So to actually give attention to the social struggle that's required in order to root out Bolsonarismo in a genuine way, you need to think, what are the demands to which Bolsonarismo, the material demands to which Bolsonarismo is responding? And here again, it's worth us discussing questions of values and culture, what might be referred to as Brazil's culture war. But Brazil's culture war has itself a material basis. So I'm no expert on evangelicalism and its rise over over the last couple of decades, the appeal to evangelicalism in this current moment has been in let's say the period between the two presidential election turns, has been an appeal on the basis of values. But people aren't drawn to evangelicalism. And it's worth noting that the evangelical community is itself fragmented by nature. It isn't a religious community that has a strict hierarchy. There are different sorts of denominations with different responding to different authorities. But that people aren't drawn on the basis of a certain kind of faith. The faith is developed in after the connection. And the connection, and this is a very, I suppose, brief or simplistic description of how evangelicalism has risen in Brazil, but really it's on the back of grassroots organizing. It's what people call trabalho de base. The trabalho de base that the left has been unable to do over recent decades is the work that has been done in some sense by evangelical churches, and that is the provision not just of certain material benefits, but actually the provision of a narrative, the provision of a project of life, and even in some sense the provision of a horizon. The thing is that in many cases, the most successful of the new evangelical churches, both Pentecostalist and Neo-Pentecostalist, have done so along lines which incline people ideologically to a sort of individualism, an idea of aspiration and prosperity, which is itself very much aligned with the political and social project of Bolsonarism. And that is what I was saying before, that in order to expand Brazilian capitalism across certain frontiers, there's a need to set society against itself. There's a need to fuel this war for work and the war of all, everyone against everyone. And so those people who, during Lula's government, experience a certain improvement in their material conditions that formed or that constituted what was considered a new middle class, this class C, and then fell back down into a sort of broad precariat. And that this social class oftentimes has been the class that has provided a basis for Bolsonarismo. That this is a class of people that have understood that there is a war going on, and if I'm to survive, I need to back myself. But it's an individual project, and it's this idea that the left needs to challenge, and needs to challenge it not just through rhetoric and ideology, but actually through trying to understand a social formation that isn't conducive to the type of social and political organizing of the past, and therefore the need to create new grassroots or base alliances which don't currently exist. It's also a project in which class conflict, in the conventional terms, is much liver. It's much more live. Cool. And there's therefore a need to recognize that politics itself is a form of conflict. And the project of conciliation, which was never just tactics on the part of the PT, but is necessary now to build this coalition to provide a negation or to negate what is being proposed by Bolsonaro, that isn't an ideal. And that has been built into progressive ideology in Brazil. And that, I think, also needs to be challenged if there's any chance of Bolsonarismo, because the right have bought into this very clearly, the new right. They see politics as a war, and we are going to engage in it with blood and fury. And that's what the left still needs to come to terms with. There was an opportunity in this election, after all the destruction caused by Bolsonaro over the last 4 years. There was a real opportunity not just to defeat Bolsonaro in the elections, but also to build something of a new basis for progressive politics. I'm not saying that hasn't happened, and there's been incredible, quite organic organizing that has taken place in between the first and second rounds of this election. And in fact, that might well be what's contributing in the last few days to an upturn in Lula's rating. There was a closing of the polls, and we obviously have to speak quite cautiously about polls after the first round in particular. But it does seem that Bolsonaro's rejection has gone up again a bit, and the difference between the two candidates has opened, which gives us hope for this coming Sunday, But the challenge ahead, as I'll repeat, is to confront Bolsonarismo as something that has a social and political basis inside Brazil. And yes, there is interference that will always occur, because that is the nature of international capitalism and of empire. But that there's something that has to be done internally that enables struggle and enables coalition building for a new progressive politics.
Thanks, Giuliano. I'm going to ask a specific question to Sabrina and to Michael. We've got David Raby in the audience. So David is a writer on Latin American affairs and academic. He's actually will be speaking at our next Alvarado Online on Mexico. And he's asked a question, and I'll read the comment out for those that missed it. He says, if, and it's clearly a big if, Lula wins, it's not a question of being socialist or social democrat or whatever. What is necessary, as we've seen in one country after another, Bolivia, Mexico, Chile, Peru, Argentina, Honduras, is to change the direction of travel. Mm. A progressive government takes power, there is no way of knowing how far it may go. Everything depends on the ongoing political dynamic. Do you agree? So Sabrina and then Michael, and Natalia as well after, but I also, and Natalia, if you could also clarify, there's a comment there, if you could clarify what Lula said around imperialism, around his thoughts on imperialism. And I think someone asked a question around his declarations on Venezuela and the need for quote unquote free elections in Venezuela. So Sabrina, what are your thoughts on David's comment? Do you agree? And you know, we've discussed the strength of Bolsonaro at the state level in the elections of early October and this bloc that will have power in Brazil. What do you think of David's comment?
What is interesting here in terms of like a change of travel is that even if we base ourselves on what Lula has said, sometimes it feels like it's a change of travel back into the past, because he's been really using this melancholia of, you know, his first governments, that things were better, that he left government with like a very high rate of approval. He was able to implement a lot of different benefits through social policy in the country. And in a sense, this has actually hurt Lula a little in terms of being able to communicate the program. He's been criticized for that. It opened a loophole for the Bolsonaristas to claim that Lula has no proposals and no programs. And even last week, Lula was in one of the major Brazilian podcasts. And when he got asked about this, he said something sort of like, well, when you govern before, people sort of know what you're going to do. I was like, it's not a good answer to this question. Yet, when the campaign started putting certain proposals forward, like they started picking a couple of things out of the large program and certain things that came in through negotiations through the coalitions and this expanded coalition that we already actually see some of the results from this, right? We got this big research poll results just recently. And we saw that, for example, Simone Tebet, who's part of the big coalition now, who was one of the candidates who did better than Ciro Gomes, so she was in the third place. The majority of her electorate is now going towards Lula, whereas those who were going with Ciro Gomes, it's about half and half. You know, there's some undecided, there's about half and half, but also because Ciro Gomes was a lot more anti-Petista, anti-Lula throughout his campaign and even from before. With Simone Tebet, she was a bit more in terms of conciliation. And the proposals that Lula are bringing forward as these highlights, they actually change a lot in terms of the material reality of the poor in Brazil. So if it does go forward with changing the pricing policy for fuel at Petrobras, this is going to affect not only fuel prices, but it's also going to affect food prices. It's going to have like a direct beneficial effect that can also be used in a way that that one of the Petrobras workers union, FUPI, has been claimed that it empowers the company with the people to see the company in its role as a public entity that can also be key for climate transition. Something else that Lula has been talking about is renegotiating people's debt. So he doesn't need that much of support in Congress to be able to work certain things around with his economic partners, either through the ministries or the central bank or some of the external allies. So there's some hope that the political dynamic will change in terms of providing people with basic support again. And one of the big hopes that we have is actually in terms of fighting hunger, because we know that half of the Brazilian population is at some state of food insecurity nowadays. So this is quite key for us. Whether this goes into something very, very progressive, this depends a lot. I do consider the program that's being submitted, what's written, to be more progressive than Lula's previous governments. Actually, there are some certain things here there in terms of talking about like family agriculture, agroecology, even progressive tax reform that are a big advancement actually. But we know that Lula is pretty much stuck with a very, very right-wing Congress right now, both the Chamber of Deputies and the Senate. So this affects a lot of his capacity. And it's also one of those things, Lula is not that the question is whether it's about socialism or barbarism, like Juliano said, but it's also the sense that Lula doesn't mean to go that far anyway. It is not his intention to build a leftist government. It is his intention to build a functional government with social policy that can tend to the needs of the poor and the working class in Brazil. And he's willing to buy into a lot of these contradictions. And he also wants to keep this perspective of a win-win situation. This was something that he was quite proud of in the past. There's a saying, like a famous saying from Lula that we tend to quote a lot in Brazil. There's like never before in the history of the country. And then Lula says that, you know, agribusiness makes so money as they did under me. And the banks made so money and so much money, and that was because of me. So Lula is actually probably one of the biggest ones in terms of nostalgia in the country. It's not just part of the discourse, but Lula is very nostalgic for those good old days when he was able to negotiate things with a different political forces and actors in Brazil and get people out to a certain level of stability. We know that he'll be able to do some of that, but of course we have the big drawback is that once you're negotiating class power in that sense, we know that the capitalist class is the strongest one, and it is willing to throw Lula under the bus if necessary, as they did with Dilma. So we have to be quite careful with these this strategy around class conciliation that Lula doesn't even acknowledge that's what he was doing. He's like, no, I'm just, you know, it's just governability. That's how you govern. This is the only way to govern. And there's been like a series of critiques coming from the Workers' Party. Even Dilma Rousseff, more recently in the past year or so, has been giving interviews talking about the necessity to separate the party from the government, so that the Workers' Party can keep mobilizing, can keep applying pressure, so these things don't get amalgamated into one. And this is important in terms of thinking what movement we get out of this, because these recent polling also gave us some interesting data in terms of like how the percentage of people in Brazil who identify as Bolsonarista rather than Petista. And of course, more will identify as Bolsonarista because this is just a broad movement. It's not tied to one party, one institution, and it's not even tied just to the figure of Bolsonaro, Bolsonarismo. And this is part of the question, like, do we change this name? Do we see this as something else? But Bolsonarismo has its roots in what we were calling sort of the alt-right, the new right in Brazil. And then Bolsonarismo brings in the personality of Bolsonaro as something that can be centered upon. But what we are quite aware of is that perhaps the left in Brazil needs something way bigger than the notion of fascismo or even lulismo, because a lot of people don't even identify lulismo. The term lulismo was usually used not to refer to the phenomenon, but actually the way of governing by Lula, something that André Singer talked about in the past. So can the left actually build something else that can make a counterpoint to Bolsonarismo that's not simply anti-Bolsonarismo, because anti-Bolsonarismo is larger than Bolsonarismo today, but it's actually quite vague. It is the broadest of fronts, and what kind of direction we can get out of this is a completely different question. And it goes back to the point on grassroots organizing, trabalho de base, and what kind of political project that you show society that has to be based on antagonisms, on pointing out those who have been profiting all along and who are willing to go after democratic rights if necessary, if they can keep their profits going.
Thank you, Sabrina. So initially I said to Michael to reflect on David's question, but there's so much that we've covered. I see the comment section is also very busy. So Michael, I'm just going to give you free rein. Do you want to pick up on anything that's that you've heard the other speakers say that you'd like to add or even, disagree with?
Absolutely. I would just say that I think one of the important things that we've that hasn't been talked about enough, particularly in the international press around this election, is that, yes, of course, Congress and Senate is going to be, even if Lula comes to power, more conservative than ever. But at the same time, the Workers' Party did well. It picked up as many seats in Congress as it had back in 2016 before Dilma Rousseff was taken out of power, right around the time of the Lava Jato stuff. So it's actually the Workers' Party in a lot of ways has come back. Plus, if you include those in the working in the Workers' Party coalition, then they're just a few seats less than Bolsonaro's PL. So that's just important context. Also remember that Lula, you know, he battled with a conservative Congress back in his first term and second term as well. He ruled a lot of times by decree. It wasn't just by pushing things through Congress. And I just say that, yes, right now, within the country, it is a coalition that is obviously anti-Bolsonaro, but it's also a coalition for something, right? It's a coalition for unity and democracy. And when you talk about Lula, yes, of course, there are specific campaign proposals, but what he represents is kind of this return to a developmentalism, state institutions strong, workers' rights, lifting people out of poverty, social programs. You know, that image is really clear in people's minds, particularly up in, say, you go to Pernambuco in northeastern Brazil. Everyone has a really clear idea about what Lula did to help them and what they expect kind of from a Lula government at this point. So I think that's just something I just want to push back a little bit on that understanding that it's, I don't think it's going to be as bad as many people are talking about. And actually the Workers' Party has done pretty well. And the Workers' Party is still strong. It's important in the country. And that's what these last elections shown as well. I did want to put one thing into context that I think was really important that Natalia was talking about. And that's just that Brazil, the reason why Brazil is so huge, I mean, it's so important in the region, why a Lula election is so important is, look, it's roughly half the size of South America, has roughly half the population of South America, and has roughly half the GDP. So that has roughly the same GDP of all the other countries combined. That's why it's such an important country for the region. And in terms of regional integration, that's why I say, you know, when Lula was in power back in the 2000s, you had the Pink Tide governments. It was absolutely key to have Brazil align with Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Cuba, because it gave clout and it gave support and force to those countries in a way that if Brazil was not there, they wouldn't have had before. And so I think that's something just really important to understand, like on that level, why that's so key. The other thing that is really important is in speaking with members of the MST in recent weeks, one of the things that they've done is built these popular committees in poor communities up and down the country. And they've done this in coalition with urban movements as well. And actually part of it was taken out of a lot of the organizing that happened during COVID, you know, when people were didn't have enough food on their tables and the MST was organizing with urban communities in order to get food and bring that to folks in favelas up and down Brazil. And so they kind of built off that. And over the last, well, just during this year, they've built somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 popular committees with the idea of organizing in the grassroots for Lula's campaign, but then also building beyond, whatever happened in these elections to have these kind of grassroots committees in there. That type of stuff is, I think, really exciting. It hasn't gotten a lot of coverage, but it's happening in neighborhoods also up and down Brazil. And I think that's really key because it also shows kind of the unity that you have right now among social movements in Brazil. The other thing, obviously, folks, leaders of the MST, I was at a press conference just before the first round vote. And one of the main things that they were talking about was the need for a mass popular movement that we haven't seen in Brazil in a really long time. Now, of course, that's hard to do. It's hard to implement, but that's something that that type of organizing from below is going to be extremely important going forward if there is a Lula government, in order to be able to push these kind of progressive policies that people would like to see. And of course, that's the contradiction. It's the same contradiction we had back in the 2000s, right? The complication of building kind of a coalition government and then trying to be able to push through more progressive measures and more progressive laws and acts and decrees, that's going to help with kind of that popular support. But it's very, very clear in the grassroots about what needs to be happened kind of on that level. The last thing I'll say is that I think is really interesting. I spoke with Marina Silva, which is, of course, Lula's former environment minister, who then split and then was a presidential candidate fighting against the Workers' Party for several administrations. She's now back in his coalition, as we've seen, and in many different protests and rallies in support of Lula. But I spoke with her at one of these rallies just a few weeks ago, and she had said she had already handed to Lula kind of a dossier of what she believes is necessary in order to get to zero deforestation. Now, zero deforestation is not a reality, but it is, I think, really interesting and exciting to see her back in coalition. Of course, she brings her kind of evangelical clout to this, right? And so tries to help Lula kind of embrace kind of the evangelical community, but also the fact that she's, you know, willing to unite and get in coalition again with the focus on really trying to battle deforestation and what's happening in the Amazon and elsewhere around the country. So I think that's a really interesting kind of development that we've seen in the last, you know, couple of weeks, few months.
Finally, Natalia, again, a chance to reflect on what the other speakers have said. I think there was that question around clarifying Lula's statements on imperialism and his statements on Venezuela. Over to you.
So when I interview Lula, I ask him specifically about the U.S. imperialism, especially regarding the role that the Department of Justice played on Lava Jato, where the FBI, the CIA, and Sergio Moro, who is now again supporting Bolsonaro, they were apart, but now they are again together anyway. And Lula told me that he did not use the word imperialism because of his political education, but saying that, he also said that he believed that the American government only don't try to topple the government of their own country. And he reminded the fact that during his government, he tried in several ways to diminish the influence of the USA in the regional politics, especially trying to break a deal with Argentina to try to make negotiations, economical trading using pesos and reais instead of dollars, because he said no one has ever asked us if we wanted to use dollars. It was imposed to us by the United States. So he said that the United States never accepted the dominance over the Brazil sovereignty and dominance over Pre-Sal, reminding that this was, again, like I said, one of the reasons why we had all that international campaign of defamation against the Workers' Party, because the oil companies were after what Brazil has in Pre-Sal. And he said that Brazil was always treated as a less than a serious country by the United States mainly. And the fact that under his government, under PT's, because we have to always remember Dilma's government as well, Brazil was becoming too big. And whenever a country becomes too big for the USA, it's time to topple the government, it's time to end the government, it's try to regain their power again. That's why he was very clear to say that he will do his best for any country of the region, never needs the help of the United States, because he said United States don't help countries, they promote coups There is no free help coming from the United States. They don't want what is best for Latin America. They want what is best for them. And what is best for them is to continue to explore freely Latin America. So even though he said he doesn't like to use the word imperialism, he was very clear that he does believe in the US imperialism in the region, and that he will continue to fight against that imperialism. And regarding Venezuela, it's interesting that people try always, especially in Venezuela, Nicaragua anyway, that people try to pitch Lula against Maduro, or try to pitch Lula against Ortega, or anyway. But those presidents recently wrote letters in support to Lula. Whenever I speak with people in Nicaragua, they always like are very fond memories of like the importance of Lula for Latin America, especially again, he's one of the founding members with Fidel Castro of Foro de São Paulo, and how those countries wouldn't be able to do a lot of like their international pleas of solidarity without Foro de São Paulo. So I would say that Lula, many times he's pressured by people to try to distance himself publicly of those countries. But when it comes to terms of like negotiating, or even in the possibility of Brazil would sanction those countries, no, he would never do that. He is someone that understands the importance of sovereignty. He understands especially the power of the people, the will of people, and he will always respect that. And he has a tremendous respect for the history of the Chavismo in Venezuela and the Sandinista revolution in Nicaragua, and of course, Cuba, which was the first country he visited after he was released from his political imprisonment. So I would say that in comparison to all the other leaders that we have now from the new pink tide, Lula would be the one that would be most willing to engage with the ones there from the bad left in Latin America.
Thank you, Natalia, and thank you to all the speakers. We're running out of time, but it has flown by, and there's been, just so much complexity and quite a lot of hope, which is really nice in today's discussion, and some of the kind of reality of what we're up against as well. I'm going to come to each of you and ask you in kind of 1 minute, 1.5 minutes, to give me your sort of predictions of what you think that we're going to see in the next week and what we're going to see on Sunday. So, Juliano, over to you. He's laughing already. Can you do it in a minute? Juliano needs his mic. There we go.
Yeah, I wasn't laughing just because to do that in a minute is tricky. I was laughing because I probably have a suppressed superstitious tendency, which is which means that I don't really want to start predicting things lest they go the other way. Look, you know, as I said before, you can't place too much faith in the polls, particularly if you are on the left at the moment, because somehow Bolsonaro manages to maintain himself within an insurgent force of Brazilian politics, despite being in government. And there has been a tendency, not just in Brazil, but elsewhere over the last almost a decade, for insurgent forces to do better than predicted in the polls when it comes to actual elections. But the slight change in the polling in the last few days has provided a bit of margin for hope. So let's be positive in these last few days, direct our energies towards actually turning that positivity to action and trying to convince people in the days that are left to vote for Lula, and then use the energy that has existed in organizing over this electoral period to do something more positive than the anti-Bolsonaro project, which is necessary. As I said, it's necessary, but it will be insufficient to actually overcome Bolsonarism in the longer term. Thanks to everybody for participation.
Thanks, Giuliano. Over to you, Sabrina.
Yes, I hate making predictions. I'm full on pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. So my predictions tend to be very pessimistic. People don't want me talking about the end of the world and things like that. But so I'm going to talk about optimism of the will. Something that we saw come along in 2018 when we were fighting Bolsonaro in the second round, and we're seeing it even stronger right now, is the level of volunteering in the campaign. You know, people who do not consider themselves to be militants, activists, are actually in the streets. They're making pamphlets, they're talking to people. I spent the past weeks organizing with comrades groups of people who are not affiliated to any parties, no social movements or anything like that, but wanted to do something. So thousands of them, getting their material, getting them together in groups so they can go out canvassing and doing things like that. And that gives me hope, because we know that it shows that it's very porous. We have people in many different places. It's not just about these big endorsements that Lula got. This is important too, of course. It helps you build legitimacy, but we have people talking face to face. And I always believe that this process can lead into something else as well. So it's not just about the results of the election here, but what kind of conversation about politics we can engage with society about, and get it going, talking about projects and dreams and what we want to see. And in a certain way, a lot of what we've been doing in the past weeks has been not just to show that Bolsonaro is going to be absolutely awful, because, and this is something that Michael stressed, but that Bolsonaro would get so much legitimacy from a second term. So he would be able to do things that he wasn't bold enough to do this time. So we need to stop that, absolutely. But we also need to talk about what kind of Brazil that we want. And the conversation with women in particular has been amazing. So even women who are more on the conservative side, who don't tend to think, you know, in terms of a progressive agenda, they're thinking about care and education and, you know, safer communities. And I think this is where my optimism is going to come from, and I want to keep it for a long time.
Nice, thank you. Thanks for sharing, Sabrina. And over to Michael. What can we expect for the next week and for Sunday?
Okay, so I mean, they're going to be some intense campaigns. I think obviously what we've already seen from social media and fake news and everything else, it's already been bad, and it's going to get worse in the coming days leading up to the vote. On the positive side, I was very pessimistic the last couple of days. I spoke today with a professor who studied the WhatsApp groups and the Telegram groups at the University of Virginia named David Nimmer, and he's done a lot of work around this stuff. And he was more optimistic, which makes me more optimistic, and I'll share that with you. I mean, one of the things he said was obviously Lula failed to win in the first round by roughly 1.6 million votes, some odd. Bolsonaro, after the first round, he still needed 6 or 7. At this point, the way the polls lay out, he would need to pick up a lot. And of course, the polls in Brazil, you can't really trust them very well. But still, he would have to pick up an enormous, and Lula would actually have to roll to lose that much more. So I'm becoming more optimistic, although I'm totally crossing my fingers. The other thing that he mentioned today, the professor, is that according to some of the most recent reports, something like 75% of the votes are locked in, meaning that, you know, the people who are going to vote for Lula and the people who are going to vote for Bolsonaro, they know who they're going to go for, and those aren't, you know, they're not going to shame those votes. And so that means that there's kind of wiggle room in there. And of course, the third party candidates, they by and large, of course, Ciro much less, but still by and large backed Lula. So I think that we're going to see a positive result on Sunday. The one thing I do want to end with, which is not positive, is the fact that I've been speaking with Bolsonaro supporters up and down the country over the last month. And almost every single one of them told me that they are very clear that they are going to win the elections. And if they don't, there's a problem with the democratic system. And so regardless of if there's, you know, fraud claims or Bolsonaro tries to do something later on, it's still concerning that a major portion of the country, maybe 10, 15, 20% of the population, backs completely Bolsonaro and does not believe that it was a legitimate election, just like we see in the United States with Donald Trump. So that's just, you know, I mean, that is not positive at all, but that's what the reality is going to be going forward.
Thank you, Michael. No, an important dose of reality there at the end. And over to Natalia, and then I'll hand back to Pablo.
I think it's very important that regarding the results that people be aware that there has been many episodes of political violence, which is something that has to be talked because the international mainstream media tends to try to dilute or ignore when there is no one like died or anything like that, or even when they do, like people tend to not understand that Bolsonaro has been radicalizing his support from the past 4 years to now. And even though I don't believe that we're gonna have a January 6th, like a full insurrection, we're gonna have those isolated cases in several states in Brazil, several cities of Brazil, like they're already happening now. So I think it's important to people to realize that regardless of the results, which I do believe honestly that will be pro Lula, that those radicalized people will not disappear, they will not vanish and thin air, they will be still there, and they do think they are above the law, they are thinking that they are righteous or martyrs or whatever. So I think it's very important for people to be mindful that it's very dangerous for you right now in Brazil to show, to walk around wearing a red flag, carrying a MST hat or like a Lula flag, a Lula shirt, because they are out to get many people. So don't be fooled to think this is just Bolsonaro telling bullshit on the internet or anything. No, people are like legitimately scared. People are being attacked. People are having their houses shot, people are being beaten. So we always have to be mindful that Bolsonaro might be gone, but the damage that he did against the Brazilian people will be stay there. So we're gonna need many, many years of like political education for people to leave that dark well where Bolsonaro put them. So yes, I do believe Lula will have many challenges to overcome, but not just Lula, but like the left in Brazil in general, and re-educating people to make them see that the hatred, the path of hatred is not the correct path to put Brazil in the place where Brazil should be, which is a great, amazing, beautiful, magical country.
Thank you, Natalia. With those cautiously optimistic words, we're going to wrap up and end this event. So thanks, Natalia. Thanks, Giuliano. Thank you, Sabrina. Thank you, Mike Box, for giving us your informed insights, your sober analysis, the hope, the optimism of the will. And thank you to those that joined us, to those that engaged on the chat. It was a very busy chat, Ian Drummond, and thank you for his multiple comments. We're going to put this event up on our website in a couple of days. So, you know, feel free to check the website, share it. And yeah, let's bring that hope so that Brazil on Sunday will get rid of the nightmare that is Bolsonaro and start rebuilding democracy, because it does seem that there is a very deep need to rebuild democracy and to repair all the damage that has been done by Bolsonaro. So thank you to the speaker, thank you to the audience, and come and join us in 2 weeks' time, I think, where Nick, the co-editor, will be chairing a debate on what's going on in Mexico under AMLO. with David, who was in the audience, speaker and others. And thank you for coming. I think we're going to end with a Chico Buarque song that we played at the beginning. So see you next time.